This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
I definitely want to talk about, you've got an essay in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review, which is some of the best writing that I think I've ever read about Iraq. I mean, really powerful, full of information. And so we definitely want to talk about that. But before we get there to your experience on the ground in Iraq, give us a little David Morris 101, where you're from, and a little bit about your service.
Well, I grew up in Southern California, grew up in rural San Diego County, joined the Marine Corps when I was in college, did the ROTC thing, served in the Marine Corps Infantry for a couple years, and this is sort of in, you know, probably the most peaceful 7-8 years, you know, pre-9/11, post-Desert Storm, so kind of a peacetime Marine Corps situation. Got out, kind of wandered a little bit. 9/11 happened, and I found myself as, you know, sort of a struggling writer, and found myself, like a lot of people, sort of, you know, fascinated by the dark weirdness and the kaleidoscope of politics and terrorism in Iraq and the Middle East.
Tell us about your trips to Iraq and set it up, Dave, if you could, with when you first started thinking about writing about the Marines.
Well, I, as I mentioned, I served in the Marine Corps and came from sort of a military family. I grew up in San Diego in the Reagan era. A lot of my neighbors were Top Gun instructors or Vietnam veterans and Marine officers, and so I'd always kind of been around this thing and had been drawn into the service out of curiosity to a large extent, for just, you know, what it was like to serve in that kind of environment. And I'd always kind of secretly wanted to be a writer. Hadn't really read much Hemingway, but eventually came around to that. And I'd written a history book about the 1991 Gulf War, and had sort of found myself in a position of having written about it and thought about it and been trained to do it. And then the Iraq War started, war which I'd never really had any support for, but still curious about what the experience was like. One day on book tour, I was aboard a Marine base and just happened to ask one of the public affairs officers what it would, you know, what getting embedded involved, what it actually took to get embedded. And he just looked at me and asked me what what's your blood type? And, you know, signed a couple forms, and it was pretty much on autopilot from there. So it was sort of surprisingly simple. From that standpoint.
Is that because you were an established writer or because you were a former Marine, or both?
A little bit of both. Marines are very sort of evangelical about what they're doing and their mission, and are sort of, you know, famously enthusiastic about their service and the esprit de corps thing and all that. And so they're always looking for good stories to be told about them. And this is in 04 when the war definitely had a different flavor. And so they saw me as sort of, you know, a good opportunity to get some good stories or maybe a more empathetic story about what Marines are doing out there and how the mission was going. You gotta sort of play both sides of the fence. I definitely am interested in talking to Marines and getting their side of the story, but, you know, good writing isn't going to be a paid promotional advertisement for the Pentagon, so you have to kind of find a way to talk about it that's both intellectually honest and true to what you're seeing on the ground.
Former Marine and author Dave Morris is our guest. His book is Storm on the Horizon. He's also the author of an essay in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review, which is on bookstands now. The essay is The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground. Dave, your essay, The Big Suck, tell us about this and about your trips to Iraq. Where exactly did you go, and share some of the things that you learned when you went over there?
Well, this was my second trip back to Iraq. I'd been there in 04 when sort of the hard truths of you know, guerrilla warfare and the long agony of the occupation was kind of just, we were just kind of waking up to the nightmare, I think, in 2004. And I came back in 2006, and, you know, a lot of things had changed, and there was sort of you know, just to even get back into the country, I took a lot more work, a lot more bureaucratic work to get back in. And I had to spend a week in Baghdad just to get officially blessed by the press information officers there in the green zone. So kind of made my way through Baghdad, and I noticed how things had changed since 2004 because, you know, there was just a more permanent feel to it. A lot of the facilities there have been, you know, armored and have more of a, you know, there's definitely more of a Little America kind of feel in Iraq these days. A lot more infrastructure there, a lot more permanence, a feel of kind of a, you know, sort of, you know, a more permanent presence there. So I made my way through Baghdad, spent most of my time in the Al-Anbar province, which is the western one-third of the country. Spent some time in Fallujah, sort of seeing how things had changed since the big battle of 2004 there in the city of Fallujah. I was one of the first journalists allowed back into the city of Ramadi, which had been off limits to journalists for some time. And that was a pretty scary place. It was definitely, you know, probably the most dangerous place in Iraq at this stage. Spent some time there, made my way back, and spent a week with a U.S. advisory team that's advising the Iraqi army, just living among Iraqis and eating their food for a week.
Your essay is The Big Suck. Tell us about the title.
Well, The Big Suck's kind of sort of part of Marine slang, and a lot of Marines historically will sort of refer to the Corps as the Suck or the Big Suck. And when I got to Ramadi, that was sort of the vibe I got of, you know, this is sort of ground zero for the war, kind of the baddest of the bad places to be, or, you know, kind of the Big Suck. And it was, you know, a place that Marines sort of take pride in, you know, accepting very bad situations and being okay with taking a lot of casualties, and Ramadi was definitely the darkest, grimmest show that is happening in Iraq. A lot of people are a lot of Americans and locals are losing their lives in Ramadi, and that the Big Suck was just kind of the feel the place had. That, you know, welcome to the worst place on earth.
I think one thing a lot of people would like to know is what's the mood of the troops over there right now? What are you hearing from them about the leadership in Washington, about the entire enterprise?
Well, it's funny because there is, you know, we talk about the war from a sort of a newsy perspective and a particular, you know, the political ramifications of stuff that's going on over there, and for the most part, servicemen are almost allergic to politics, and particularly among someone who's, you know, a journalist, that's really the last thing that they really want to talk about. And they're, you know, it's kind of, for a lot of them, it's a survival trip over there. You know, and to be perfectly honest, and this sort of shocks a lot of people, among a lot of the special forces soldiers and Marines and certain, you know, certain units, there are people that are there and enjoying the adventure and have trained to be in combat for most of their lives, and are, you know, sort of interested in the experience and you know, are sort of connoisseurs of the war at a certain level. But there is also, you know, among a lot of the other troops, just sort of a survival mechanism in place. They're not terribly concerned about the politics, although I certainly ran into some officers who told me that they would not be voting for President, you know, for Bush again. But a lot of them are very focused on the fine-grained details of their job.
Tell us about, you were talking about in Ramadi and how frightening it was. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, it was funny. That place was so bad, and, you know, when you try to think about flying to these places, you know, and sort of leaving suburban America and flying across the Atlantic and embedding yourself in a military unit, there is sort of a psychological accommodation that you have to go through to transition into these really dangerous places. But once you kind of settle in, it's, you know, you fear and really intense fear becomes too exhausting to maintain after you've been in these type of environments for an extended period of time. And you just sort of develop this kind of, you know, weird ease with being around people getting wounded and you know, getting mortared every day, and you know, listen to bombs go off, you know, a couple times every night. And there was one point, and I'm not, you know, I certainly didn't see that intense of combat or anything that really was that remarkable, but there is sort of a point at which you sort of cross over and say, well, you know, if I die, it's just me dying, and you kind of reach this almost metaphysical stopping point where, you know, it's too exhausting to worry about it in the normal sense, and you kind of develop this different emotional register. You know, just kind of evolves while you're over there. And then a lot of the Marines that have and soldiers that have been there for a long, long time, month after month, you can't exist in sort of a normal, easily explained, a normal kind of mindset. You know, you sort of become somebody else.
My guest is Dave Morris, former Marine and author of the book Storm on the Horizon, about the Battle of Kafji in the Gulf War. He's got an essay in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review titled The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground. Dave, what is the sense among the Marines in Iraq that you spent time with on two trips to Iraq? Do they have a sense of, what's the sense of the mission? You know, it was to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. There were none. There was a sense that we were freeing people, bringing democracy to Iraq. Is there any talk among the Marines of that grand scheme, this grand plan, or is it just sort of a day-to-day, I'm doing my job?
Well, it kind of varies from soldier to soldier and Marine to Marine, but there's definitely, you don't really get any grand sense of the scheme of this vision of Iraq, these ideas about democracy really taking hold and it being this great, you know, shining beacon of democratic society that you would still get that kind of vibe from Marines in 2004 that this was really going to be, you know, you got kind of that evangelical sort of zeal for the mission that this was really going to be something. This was something new and historic, and we were exporting something of America overseas. There is sort of cynicism among a lot of the troops and just sort of like, well, I'm here to do my job. And one officer told me to make sure to not quote him on this. But he mentioned that, you know, he wasn't terribly concerned about the people of Ramadi or bringing democracy to the city of Ramadi. He just thought it was great training for his troops and was glad for the opportunity to be in a good fight for once.
What did you learn about the Iraqi troops? We often hear, you know, whenever we turn on the news, often we hear, well, when the Iraqi troops stand up, then we will stand down. What's the sense among the Marines and what you were able to learn about the fitness of the Iraqi troops and what's going on in that regard?
Well, again, that varies a little bit from unit to unit, but I would say, you know, there are some good. I spent some time with some advisory teams. And there are some good baby steps being taken towards professionalizing the Iraqi army. But it's sort of funny because we're trying to sort of communicate this Western military ideal to Arab troops, and a lot seems to get lost in translation. Most of the units that I spent time with were not terribly competent and had a long way to go towards being, you know, traditionally dependable and proficient Western troops. I think there are a lot of institutional things that still need to happen that are not happening. There really are no Iraqi troops aren't being sent back stateside to attend U.S. training schools. There's no, you know, institutional or training oriented, you know, larger programs really being set up. There's just sort of, you know, putting a Band-Aid on the situation for the moment. And the week that I spent with a Marine advisory team west of Fallujah was really eye-opening for me, because they were very, very frustrated, felt, profoundly undersupplied, and felt sort of like the redheaded stepchildren of the American effort there. So there was a lot of frustration in that regard in Iraq.
My guest is author and former Marine Dave Morris. His essay is The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground, in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review. If you have a question or a comment, you're welcome to join the conversation at 977-1070. Dave, what's the? Are there any thoughts among the Marines that you spent time with in Iraq regarding Iran? And, you know, we're hearing a lot of saber-rattling in Washington now about Iran.
Yeah, you don't really, they didn't talk so much about that. That wasn't really, you know, and in fact, I was in Ramadi when the war broke out, when the fighting broke out in Lebanon, and you know, Israeli troops inside Lebanon and the fighting in Beirut. And they are very, you know, you'd be surprised at the degree to which you sort of become completely immersed in the three-block war that you're fighting. And most of the troops that I spoke with didn't really have much of an interest in what Iran was up to. I will tell you personally, I think the U.S. military is extended enough that, you know, trying to take on the Iranian situation or you know, launch some sort of land-based offensive into Iran is sort of folly at this stage, because we're, you know, unless we institute a draft, because the U.S. military is pretty well tapped out at this stage dealing with Iraq.
What are your feelings about President Bush's quote-unquote surge strategy?
Well, it's a case of too little, too late. I don't think, you know, most of the troops that have been surveyed about the plan don't really have much faith in it. It doesn't really matter if you flood an area with 5% more troops for a period of time. You know, to be honest, I think one of the ridiculous things about any conversation that we have about Iraq is that it's almost entirely focused on the political cycle inside the Beltway and what is of interest to either party, you know, and very rarely, if ever, do we hear about what the Iraqi people need, what's happening on the ground there in terms of actual tactical events, and what the professional informed opinion is. You know, what we talk about the surge in terms of political capital, what it will cost, the Republican Party, or, you know, why they're undertaking this plan, what Bush says about it, but it really has very little relevance on the ground. I don't think it's gonna have, you know, it's not gonna have an appreciable impact, in my opinion. Baghdad is a huge city, you know, of upwards of 10 million citizens. We're not, you know, flooding 20,000 more troops into, you know, pouring them into that environment isn't gonna have much of an effect. It's too late and it's too little.
What would have an effect at this point? What's your feeling about what should be done?
Well, I mean, the major problem is the U.S. is historically very poor at fighting insurgencies. We've never really won one this century, or the 20th century for that matter. And any of the successful counterinsurgency efforts that we look at, like the British in Malaya, or the British in Greece in the 1950s, all took upwards of 15 years before the situation was finally turned around. I don't think that the American public has the patience to be involved in a bloody, casualty-intensive counterinsurgency for upwards of 10 to 15 years. It's just we aren't that patient. We don't really have that kind of international understanding and appreciation for the complexity of events, you know, which sort of raises the question of, you know, why the hell we got there. Got involved in the first place, but the shocking and disappointing thing about the deal is that you know when I was in the Marine Corps, you know, and my father was a Vietnam veteran, and when I was going through my training in Quantico, Virginia, we were told that there was a lot of awareness of sort of trying to learn the lessons of Vietnam, and I think we incorporated and internalized some of those lessons, but there's a lot that just has not changed. The U.S. military isn't really, they're slowly improving, but they're still not, we're really good at more World War II style warfare of breaking stuff and killing people. We're not very good at doing nation building stuff. And I don't, you know, there are some, you know, some suggestions or rearranging the chairs on the Titanic type, suggestions I have and ideas I have about the Iraqi situation, but, in large part little too late.
My guest is author Dave Morris, a former Marine. His book is Storm on the Horizon, and the essay that he is published in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review is titled The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of this break and find out more about what life is like day to day, morning until night, for these men and women serving in Iraq. Josh is on the line in Charlottesville. Josh, hang with us, please. This is Charlottesville Right Now. We're talking with Dave Morris, author and former Marine. His book is Storm on the Horizon, about the Battle of Kafji in the Gulf War. His essay is The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground, in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review. Dave, let's see if we can move this conversation to the day-to-day existence of these men and women, what a day is like. Can you sort of paint a picture for us, you know, morning to night? What are they actually doing day-to-day?
In some ways, they have a lot of the comforts at home, of home, but generally speaking, they'll have, you might have a couple of days back in a base where you have some hot food and you can check the internet at your leisure, and then you'll spend probably 2 weeks or a week at a more hardened post that's just a bunch of sandbags, and you know, you're eating cold food and basically looking out over the same stretch of road for a week on end, or maybe doing a couple of patrols, meeting some of the locals out in one of the towns that you might be posted to. It's sort of strange because you do have a connection to the larger world through the internet. But you also just, your personal psychological world kind of shrinks down to the size of a pinhole. You know, you've got your buddies with you, and you've got your mission and the gear that you, that sort of takes care of you, but you have a very small little view of the world, a little view of the war in that sense. When I was there, it was very, very hot. It was upwards of 115 degrees. So you're just constantly sweating. You're pretty much always covered in dust. And it's sort of funny because I sort of preferred being away from the internet and away from the television and being out on some of these posts, because you sort of retreat back to, in some ways, kind of a 19th century lifestyle, and you have whatever books you carry with you, and you have your buddies next to you and the conversations that you can have, and you know, in a way, there's just so much less baggage there that you develop friendships quicker, and a lot of the baggage that seems so essential back in the States, all the, you know, the little things of, you know, that make up our daily lives just aren't there. So you kind of have a more stripped down, you know, social experience over there, and you know, plus, you know, the death never really leaves you there, and that's always a part of your daily equation. So you kind of get, and I think this is part of one of the, for better or for worse, one of the appeals of war is that there is sort of this simpler existence and sort of a closeness that develops as a result of it, if that makes sense.
You write in your essay in the Virginia Quarterly Review about sort of the, I don't really know how to put it, but you reference the charms candies and the rounds that get dropped. Tell us about this.
Yeah, the charms candies and a lot of the Marines when I was there, you would, if you mentioned that, you know, you hadn't taken fire in a while that you hadn't taken any casualties or maybe you hadn't been IED'd that week, that kind of made people jumpy. And because, you know, in Iraq, when you're in these situations, you have really very little to no control over who gets killed and who doesn't. You sort of retreat back to this almost primal state in a way, and you become very, very superstitious because, you know, it's the only mechanism that you have really to sort of understand what's happening to you. And so a lot of people got really wiggy about, you know, talking about, you know, not having been mortared in a week or you know, what, you know, having gotten lucky or these sorts of things. And you know, superstition, which might seem laughable before, or magical, what some people call magical thinking, which seems so laughable back in the States, suddenly becomes, you know, desperately important. And the ways I've tried to write about the war sort of, you know, are trying to get at this reality in the sense that there is sort of, you know, a religious, you know, weird religious sense that you get over there about, you know, what you can do to save yourself and the superstitions and the paranoias that sort of wiggle their way into your brain over time. It's a very, you know, war is you know, one of the most irrational things that we do, and so it's unsurprising that it sort of generates an irrationality and a superstition among the people that are caught up in it.
Yeah, you talk about how Charms candies that come in field rations are actually bad luck, and they just throw those away.
Yeah, a lot of their, you know, there's sort of that. I think that kind of varies from unit to unit. But I met some guys that, you know, you get these sort of commercially produced candies that come in the MREs and the field rations, and a lot of guys would toss those. And there's sort of among grunts, there's among Marines, there's sort of this urban legend about apricots being bad luck, bad juju. So they will toss those if the dried apricots come in the field rations and these sorts of things. I mean, these sort of superstitions just sort of cling to whatever raw material sort of you have in your life when you're there.
Author and former Marine Dave Morris is my guest. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. Dave, what's the feeling among the Iraqis that you managed to communicate with, and if you got to know any or spent time with any, what's the feeling there?
Well, I don't speak Arabic, and it is, I will admit to you, it's very difficult for a person like me when you're embedded, to get a very honest or dependable view of the Iraqi position on the war. I had a couple good conversations with some local college students in Ramadi about stuff. And they, you know, they were, you know, these were educated Iraqis and were just, well, were hopeful that at some point they could go back into a somewhat normal existence. You know, it is sort of frustrating because a lot of the Iraqis that you run into, you know, their Arab culture is very much focused on saving face and maintaining public appearances. And so a lot of times you'll get, people will say stuff to Iraqi locals, will say stuff to you, and you're not really sure if they're saying that because that's what they think you want to hear, or if they're trying to, you know, manipulate you in some way, and it gets to be, you know, trying to get a sense of their view of events is very difficult.
You had mentioned at the outset of this interview that you had been opposed to the invasion of Iraq. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, I don't, my view, and this is, you know, based on my work as a historian, was just that there was never any substantive, logical reason to expect that Saddam had any weapons of mass destruction. Historically, people that develop a terrorist capability or develop or are interested in developing some sort of weapons of mass destruction capacity are typically people that don't have a very good conventional army. And the question that always came up was, well, if Saddam was able to develop a nuclear device, how would he get it to, you know, how would he deliver it to the United States? What, you know, would it be on a missile or would it be in a suitcase? And there was never any means to deliver the WMD. So I always thought the case was just really suspicious from the beginning. I think it was, you know, anybody who was digging into it saw that there was a deeper ideological agenda at work.
I'm with you on the feelings about Vietnam, primarily because of the wonderful opportunity I had to meet General Shinseki and hear him speak, and he spoke very eloquently and was quite moving about his experience in Vietnam and the leadership among the military following Vietnam. This sense in which they really took a long, hard look at themselves and said, okay, what happened and how can we improve it? And then, you know, you fast forward a couple of decades and they tried to take those lessons that they had learned, that they knew from experience, that they needed to apply these lessons. But those lessons just didn't fly in Rumsfeld's Pentagon. And, and General Shinseki, of course, is very well known that he was sort of drummed out and they didn't want to hear what he had to say, even though he was very symbolic of the lessons of Vietnam.
Yeah, and that's sort of one of the frustrating things with American history is that people only remember the lessons that they personally lived through, it seems like. And, you know, I think that the Iraq War was started right as the lion's share of most of our Vietnam veterans were leaving the service. So there wasn't really that institutional memory and that, capacity to really fly in the face of what the administration, you know, push back against what the administration was trying to do. So I think there was a lot of you know, people had just sort of forgotten a lot of the lessons of Vietnam because it had been, you know, it had been long enough that, people had were able to forget what had happened, which is very, very frustrating. And you know, obviously, you know, Virginia's new senator James Webb was very much a voice of someone saying, you know, not again, you know, and was sort of a voice of trying to remember what had happened and apply some of those lessons. But, you know, Americans don't really have a very good memory for things. And the American public, by and large, had no was not interested in the lessons of history and wasn't really asking the critical long view questions that I think needed to be asked. Whereas Iraqis and Arabs typically have a very deep sense of history and a deep sense of tribal identification that tends to think about things in terms of long-term history. That's sort of the funny thing, is that we, you know, we're reliving and we're relearning all of these lessons that we already knew and chose to forget.
Dave Morris is the former Marine and author of the book Storm on the Horizon. His essay, The Big Suck, Notes from the Jarhead Underground, is in the winter issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review on newsstands now. Dave, it's been an honor. Thank you for your service to our country and for just being a damn good writer. I really enjoy reading your work, and it honestly is some of the best writing about the situation in Iraq, and you're to be congratulated.
All right, great. Thank you, Coy.
Take care. Dave Morris, this interview will appear in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.